Zechariah chapter 9. Zechariah chapter 9 is where we will be at, moving quicker through Zechariah than we are Matthew, but we're taking it chapter by chapter. And so Zechariah chapter number 9. I'll not read the chapter in its entirety at the beginning, but we will read it as we go through it, and we'll cover every verse, at least the verses that we can make sense of. Zechariah chapter 9 begins a new section in the book of Zechariah. There are three sections, if you want to divide it. Chapter 1 through 6, 8 apocalyptic visions. Zechariah had 8 visions in one night. We looked at those 8 visions. Then chapter 6 and chapter 7, or I'm sorry, chapter 7 and chapter 8 is a Bible question answer. These men come from a nearby city. They have a question about this fast. Do we have to keep doing this fast? The answer was, you never was doing it to the Lord anyway. It's your heart that matters. Then in chapter number 8, God's going to turn the fast into a feast. That is chapter 7 and 8. Then chapter 9 through chapter 14, to the end of the book, are prophetic burdens. Straight out prophecy like you would expect to read in a book of prophecy. And there are two main prophecies given under a burden. There's chapter 9, 10, and 11. There's chapter 12, 13, and 14. If you look at chapter 9 and verse 1, it opens with the burden of the Lord. If you look at chapter 12 and verse 1, identical phrase, the burden of the word of the Lord. And so that's the two divisions of this last section of the book of Zechariah. Now, just to get our bearings into the chapter, and we'll dive into this in just a minute, Zechariah 9 can be divided into two sections. There is a prophecy of two kings coming to Jerusalem. I believe that verse 1 through 8 is a prophecy of that first king. And then chapter verse number 9 through 17 is the prophecy of the second king. Now, I'll get ahead of myself a little bit, but the first king to come, I believe, has already come, so that part is now historical. The second king that is to come has not yet come, and so I believe that part is still prophetic. Now, we've been talking so much about the coming of the Lord and His kingdom because we're both in Matthew on Sunday morning and in Zechariah on Wednesday night, and both are have a lot of prophecy in both of those books. One of the things that is very crystal clear is that when Jesus comes, He will overthrow all the kingdoms of the earth and He'll set up His own kingdom. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, all the kingdoms of the world will become the kingdoms of King Jesus. And here's why that's a blessing. Is because if history has proven anything, it has proven that we are a failure at human government. I suppose the most perfect form of human government in a constitutional republic. I wouldn't want to live under anything other than a constitutional republic. But I think that if you and I knew the corruption behind our government, it would probably shock you. Even in our constitutional republic, bad laws are passed. The court system sometimes convicts innocent people. Politicians and judges are bribed. Immoral men sit in high places. This great constitutional republic, and again, I'm glad to be an American, all right? Please don't misunderstand me. But this great constitutional republic that we live under has legalized abortion. It has legalized gay marriage. It has shut down churches. It has restricted religious liberties. So human government, no matter how good it is, human government has failed. But one day when Jesus returns, He's going to defeat all the armies that are still standing. He will become the undisputed conqueror of the earth and will become the undisputed king over every nation and every kingdom. Now, the religious liberals, they hate the concept of a second coming and a millennial kingdom because it says that They can't do what Jesus is going to have to come and do. They're trying to bring in a perfect world and a perfect kingdom, and they're going to fail at that as well. Now, Zechariah chapter 9 speaks about that king that is going to come and set all of this mess straight. Now, when you get to Zechariah chapter 9, we've already covered a lot of ground as far as prophecy is concerned. But really, chapter 9 through 14 covers the same time frame as chapter 1 through chapter 8. The time that Zechariah covers is the time from his day all the way to the second coming. He covers it first in 8 visions, backs up. Now he covers it in straight prophecies. The prophecy comes in the form of a burden. It is a burden that the Holy Spirit has placed upon his heart. And that burden lays out the great future that is ahead for Israel and for the rest of the nations. Now, Zechariah chapter 9 is a difficult chapter, especially if left to stand alone. But if you're able to borrow from other prophets, it sheds a lot of light in that chapter and makes it understandable. If you are a student of Bible prophecy, you would recognize that Daniel chapter 2 is a key chapter in Bible prophecy. You may also recognize that Daniel chapter 7 is a key chapter in Bible prophecy. I believe that Daniel chapter 2, Daniel chapter 7, and Zechariah chapter 9, I believe that you put those three chapters together because they're dealing with the same theme. Now, without going back to the book of Daniel, let me quickly review what Daniel chapter 2 is about. Daniel chapter 2 is about Nebuchadnezzar, who has an image in the middle of a vision in the middle of a night of a great image, and that image is made of different parts of metal. It has a head of gold, it has a breast and arms of silver. It has a torso or a belly of brass. It has legs of iron, and the feet are iron with a mixture of clay. And the four parts of that image represent four Gentile powers, world empires that are going to come and dominate Palestine in history that is to come. Babylon, the kingdom in power at that time, is represented by the head of gold. The kingdom that will overthrow Babylon would be the Medes and Persians. They're represented by the breast and the arms of silver. The third world empire is the Grecian Empire, is represented by brass. And then the revived Roman Empire that is yet to come in times, represented by the legs of iron. You're familiar with that prophecy and that vision. But then you come to Daniel chapter 7. And in Daniel chapter 7, it is Daniel that has a vision in the middle of the night. And this time he has a vision of four beasts. Those four beasts, I believe, correlate to the four parts of Nebuchadnezzar's image. It predicts the same Gentile powers that will dominate over Palestine, just as was predicted in Daniel chapter 2. It's interesting to me that when Nebuchadnezzar saw that outline of history, he saw it as a great image, because that's how man sees himself. Man gives himself titles like Alexander the Great, Caesar the Great. However, in Daniel chapter 7, you see it as God that sees it. And God sees it much differently. He sees the kingdoms as wild beasts. There's four beasts in Daniel chapter 7. There is a lion with wings. It represents the Babylonian Empire. You'll have to study all of this out on your own. The second beast that he sees is a bear. That bear represents the Medes and the Persians. The third beast is a wild he-goat. Represents the third kingdom, the Grecian Empire, Greece. The fourth beast is undescribable. It's so terrible that he can't name it and he can't describe it. There's nothing to compare it to. And it just represents the revived Roman Empire. Now, I bring Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7 over into Zechariah chapter 9. Because I believe that Zechariah chapter 9, verse 1 through 8, doesn't deal with the four powers. I believe that those verses deal with the third power. The third Roman Empire that Daniel 2, Daniel 7 talks about is the great Grecian Empire. And it was ruled by a man named Alexander the Great. These verses, I believe, are a prophecy of judgment that God is going to bring to the enemies of Israel, but not to Israel itself. They're going to watch as a mighty conqueror sweeps through and is going to put their enemies to waste, but Jerusalem itself will be spared. The man that God is going to use for that judgment is a godless pagan man named Alexander the Great. Now, there's something that you need to note about Bible prophecy. I think it is very important to understand. There's often a dual fulfillment in prophecy. Oftentimes, something is prophesied, and it takes place in the near future. But that event or that person is also a prophecy or a type or a picture of something greater that is to come in end times. For example, in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel prophesies about a horn, a leader that is to come. We believe that leader is a man named Antiochus Epiphanes. I'll talk about him in a minute. We know about that from history. Antiochus, however, is a type of the Antichrist who is yet to come. So in Daniel chapter 7, when he describes this particular individual, there is a historical partial fulfillment in type, but the full realization of that is still to be realized in the person of the Antichrist during the tribulation. I believe the reason that the Bible does that is that it gives you a historical picture of what the future looks like. But I also believe that it does that because it says that if God can bring prophecy to pass in the past, then surely God can bring prophecy to pass in the future. The historical element of the prophecy is a signpost to say, see what I did? I told you it was going to happen. Then have no doubt that in end times it's going to happen exactly as I say. In Zechariah chapter 9, I believe you have a historical event, and I believe that you have a prophetic event. And the historical person that has already come and gone is a picture or a signpost of a person that is to come. Now, the first 8 verses deal with a man named Alexander the Great. Let me give you a very quick biography of him, and then we're going to walk through these verses. If you're still with me, say amen or grunt. All right. Bible study tonight, all right? Alexander the Great, son of the Greek king, Philip of Macedon, born in 356 B.C., became the greatest military conqueror in the world, was never defeated in battle. By the time of his death, his empire spanned most of the known world. Whenever he would conquer a new land, he would build cities, and then he would import Grecians there, Greeks. So the spread of Greek culture became all around the world. One of the biggest cities that he built, he named after himself, Alexandria, Egypt, city that still stands today. For all of his conquests, he died in 332 B.C. at the age of 32. And the Bible prophesies that upon his death, his kingdom would not pass to his sons, but it would be divided into four, and was divided in by his four generals. And then within 15 years of his death, all of his family members had been murdered. Now, I could get into the history of all the conquests of Alexander the Great, and we could try to map the lineage of all line of all of his battles. And you will rejoice and thank me for not doing that. I don't think that I could, and I don't think that I could do it and keep your interest. If I tried to talk to you about the Battle of Issus, you would not care, and neither do I. But Alexander the Great began to conquer kingdoms. The first was the Persian Empire, because that was the empire that was in power at that time. Once he took over the Persian Empire, others began to fall like dominoes before his army. Asia Minor, Syria, Palestine, Egypt, Tyre and Sidon, Philistia, and on that it went. And all of that is going to take place just a couple of hundred years from where Zechariah stood. And Zechariah is going to prophesy about that. Here's the way we'll divide the chapter. In verse 1 through 8, I want you to see a king from history. Please, if you would, in verse number 1. The burden of the word of the Lord in the land of Hadrach and Damascus shall be the rest thereof. When the eyes of man, as of all the tribes of Israel, shall be toward the Lord. The burden is a burden of judgment. That judgment will begin in Hadrach and Damascus. Archaeologists have never discovered where Hadrach is. They guess it is somewhere near Damascus. It is of no use for us to speculate. We do not know. We do know where Damascus, Syria is, and that is where this judgment is going to begin. Damascus is the capital of Syria. Syria had been one of the worst enemies of Israel for centuries, and so what it begins to say is Damascus is going to get hit. This king is going to deal with Damascus. There's a phrase, however, at the last part of the verse. When the eyes of man, as of all the tribes of Israel, shall be toward the Lord. Now, it's a difficult phrase. And I'm not sure that I know what it means. Every commentator that I have read concerning Zechariah, and there's not many, but every commentator that I have read about Alexander says that the Lord is using Alexander as an instrument of judgment. So what that verse is saying is that the nations are watching Alexander march and rampage and conquer all these things, and all of their eyes are on Alexander. They're really looking at the work of the Lord, but they're looking at Alexander. That is what every commentator says, and I don't like it. I'm not satisfied with that answer. And so we have a mystery in verse number 1. So what you do when you have a mystery that you're not sure of is you move to the next verse. So verse 2. Hamath also shall border thereby, Tyrus and Zidon, though it be very wise. Tyrus did build herself a stronghold and heaped up silver as the dust and fine gold as the mire of the streets. Behold, the Lord will cast her out, and he will smite her power in the sea, and she shall be devoured with fire. Tyre and Sidon, they're next. This is the battle plan of Alexander the Great. These are the conquests. They're the capital cities of Phoenicia, the great maritime cities. Tyre was really the capital. Sidon is always mentioned in connection with Tyre, though it was a smaller city. You probably know the history. It's very interesting to me. Tyre had been defeated years before, and they said, we'll never be defeated again. And so what the inhabitants of Tyre did is they moved their entire city out to an island out in the middle of the sea that was a half mile out in the sea. It was literally a rock, so it was a very strong fortress. They built walls of 150 feet tall around the city. The Phoenicians were the greatest sailors of the day, so they're protected by the best navy the world had ever seen at that time. But Tyre was a very evil city. Sometime you want to read Ezekiel chapter 28. You will see that Satan made it his seat on earth. They were very wealthy. That silver and gold like the dust of the street. And the story says that when Alexander came to Tyre, he sent word out there and ordered them to surrender and pay tribute. And their reply basically was, Alexander who? I have no respect for you. You can't touch us. And history says that Alexander the Great literally took the rubble from the old city of Tyre, had his army throw it into the sea, and built a causeway all the way out to that island. Marched his army to the island, and in 7 months totally destroyed the city, took tens of thousands of people captive. The carnage and the bloodshed is absolutely horrific. I believe that's prophesied in those verses. You come to verse number 5. Ashkelon shall see it and fear. Gaza shall see it and be very sorrowful. Ekron, for her expectation, shall be ashamed. And the king shall perish from Gaza, and Ashkelon shall not be inhabited. And a bastard shall dwell in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines. All of those cities are chief cities of the Philistines. And basically saying they're the next to fall. And sure enough, in history, Alexander came from Tyre and Sidon, and he came straight to Philistia, and he begins to sweep through them, and he begins to knock off those cities one by one. By the way, the king of Gaza, he decided that he would resist. We're not going to submit to Alexander the Great. We're going to fight against him. And so it slowed Alexander the Great down in his march through his conquest, and it took him 5 months to take the nation or the city of Gaza. He was mad by the time he got it. And history says that when he got into Gaza, that he took the king of Gaza and he drilled holes through his feet, ran a rope through the hole, and drug him through the streets of the city till he was dead. And hundreds of years before Alexander or that king was ever born, Zechariah said that the king shall perish from Gaza. And that's exactly what happened. We come to verse number 7. And I will take away his blood out of his mouth, and his abominations from between his teeth. But he that remaineth, even he shall be for our God. And he shall be as a governor in Judah, and Ekron as a Jebusite. I'll give you what I have read. The Philistines were pagans. And in their pagan worship, they would offer sacrifices, and they would drink the blood, and they would eat the meat that they offered on those pagan altars as part of their worship. But God would use Alexander to wipe them out, and it would end that pagan practice. And some of the Philistines would turn to God, and they would spit out their pagan sacrifices. I believe that's what verse 7 is describing. We come to verse number 8. And I will encamp about mine house because of the army, because of him that passeth by, and because of him that returneth. And no oppressor shall pass through them any more, for now have I seen with mine eyes. I will encamp about mine house. The house of the Lord on earth was the temple in Jerusalem. So I believe that verse number 8 brings us to Jerusalem. Here's what the story says, that when Alexander came to Jerusalem, he sent word to Juddah the high priest, I want you to pay tribute and I'll spare the city. And Juddah said, we're not paying tribute. And so Alexander said, as soon as I'm done taking these Philistine cities, I'm coming after you next. My plan is to destroy the foundations of the city of Jerusalem. They say that the high priest had a dream. And in that dream, God told him that you go out and you meet Alexander the Great and you welcome him into the city. Well, that would be strange. And so when Alexander the Great and his army is marching toward Jerusalem, here comes Juddah in his white priestly garments and all those garments, and he's got a procession of priests behind him. And they're marching out to meet Alexander the Great, and Alexander's army is coming, and here comes Juddah the high priest in the priestly procession. And the story says that Alexander, when he saw Juddah the high priest, that he stopped. He got off of his horse. And he came before Juddah and he bowed down before Juddah the high priest. And the men said, what are you doing? And Alexander said, years ago, I had a vision. And I had a vision of this man coming out to meet me. And because of that vision, Alexander the Great turned away. I don't know if the story is true or not. But I know that in history, Jerusalem was never touched by Alexander the Great. Because verse 8 says, I will encamp about mine house because of the army. Because of him that passeth by and returneth. Now here's an interesting phrase. Look at verse 8. And no oppressor shall pass through them any more. For now have I seen with mine eyes. There is a principle of hermeneutics you use when you're studying the Bible, and I've mentioned this to you before. It is called the gap principle. It is not the gap of Genesis 1. It is the gap principle. What the gap principle says is that sometimes there are two statements in the Bible next to each other, but there is a huge gap of time between those two statements. For example, Isaiah chapter 9 and verse number 6. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is forgiven. Has that happened? Sure it has. It happened at the first coming, didn't it? For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, colon, next statement. And the government shall be upon his shoulder. That hasn't happened yet. So between one statement and two statements, you have a colon, and we know now there's at least 2,000 years of time between those two statements. So when I read verse number 8, I come to a colon, and no oppressor shall pass through them anymore. I believe tonight that just like there's a huge gap in Isaiah 9:6, I believe there's a huge gap in Isaiah 9 and verse 8. Where it's talking about Alexander the Great, and it takes a huge leap to the time that Jesus Christ comes. And when He comes, no oppressor shall ever pass through Jerusalem again. There were oppressors to Jerusalem after Alexander the Great. There were. But there will not be after Jesus Christ. So the first 8 verses, I believe, is a prophecy about Alexander the Great. And if the first part of the prophecy takes place, then you ought to know that the second part of the prophecy will take place as well. So verse number 9 leaps forward to the coming of another king. It's the coming of King Jesus. Now, I want to stop right here for just a moment. This is Bible study night. You couldn't do this in a lot of churches, all right? I don't want to stand here tonight and give the impression that I've got all the answers and I know every verse, and I don't. In fact, Sunday night I read a verse while Brother Thomas was reading, and I read a phrase that I had never read before. And I'm not sure that I have the answer to the phrase. We were talking about it in the print shop today. Sarah Berg came up with an answer. She's got probably the best answer that I can think of. And so I'm going to go with that until I find something different. But when you know, say you know. When you don't know, don't pretend that you do know. Now, what I have given you as an interpretation of those first 8 verses, every commentator that I've ever read agrees with me. Except one. I have a commentary in my library by Brother James Knox. I love Brother Knox. He'll be preaching here in April. I love Brother Knox. He's got a commentary on the book of Zechariah. I've used it a number of times in these sermons. I think we may sell it in the bookstore. I encourage you to get it and do your own study. He does not believe these first 8 verses are about Alexander the Great. He makes a good case for why it is not. I'm not going to give you that case because I'm not making that case. But he doesn't then make a case for who it is. He just tells me who it isn't. And so I love Brother James Knox, but I think that's about Alexander the Great. Okay? You have a king from history. In verse number 9, you have a king from heaven. I do know what the last part of the book is about. Look if you would in verse number 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. Get ready to shout. The king is coming. History looks at Alexander as a great conqueror. He was nothing in comparison to Jesus Christ. And what Zechariah is getting ready to do is he's getting ready to give you the two comings of Christ. He doesn't know there's 2,000 years in between the two comings. He doesn't even know there's two comings. He just sees him coming. Now notice what he says. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. Verse 9, he is just in having salvation, lowly, and riding upon an ass and upon a colt, the foal of an ass. For you city slickers, that would be a donkey. There's an interesting story about Alexander the Great. And you may know this. His horse is almost as famous as he was. Maybe you've heard the story. The story is that there's a horse trader that came to Philip, King of Macedon, his father, and tried to sell King Philip a horse for a very high price. The horse's name was Bucephalus. Bucephalus. It was a massive animal, a great giant animal, jet black, had a white star on his forehead, had a huge head. Problem was, nobody could tame the horse. So King Philip didn't want to buy the horse. Alexander was 12, 13, 14 years old at that time. And Alexander said, "Would you let me to try to tame the horse?" And they said, "Sure, go ahead." And Alexander the Great, according to the story, noticed that the horse was really only afraid of its shadow. So Alexander the Great turned the horse to look at the sun, so he couldn't see his shadow. And by that, Alexander tamed the horse. And from that day on, nobody could ride the horse except Alexander. And that became the horse that Alexander the Great used in all of his battles. The legend of Bucephalus has grown with the legend of Alexander. He was a majestic animal. Look it up tonight. Look it up and read about it. Alexander named a city after him. They say that they even know where the horse is buried. It's just interesting to me that history has a story about the majestic horse of Alexander the Great. And in contrast, here comes Jesus riding on a donkey. Did you know that in early Israel's history, it was respectable to ride around on a donkey? It was King Solomon who began to multiply to himself horses. The stables of Solomon are still standing in Israel, overlooking the valley of Megiddo. They say that the stables of King Solomon would hold 30,000 horses. He made horses cool. And from that time on, dignitaries and kings, they began to ride on horses, and donkeys fell to the bottom of the totem pole. And anybody riding on a donkey did so because they were poor and meek and lowly and humble. And this King Jesus from heaven is going to be a lowly king. And when he came riding into Jerusalem, he wouldn't come riding Bucephalus. He would come riding the colt of an ass. And of course, we know that's exactly what happened according to Matthew chapter 21. Look at verse number 10. "I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem. And the battle bow shall be cut off. He shall speak peace unto the heathen, and his dominion shall be from sea even to sea, and from the river even to the ends of the earth." By the way, have you ever heard the phrase "from sea to shining sea"? Oh, I think that was borrowed from that verse right there, "from sea even to sea." I believe that verse 9 talks about the first coming. Verse 10 talks about the second coming. The prophets didn't see the two comings because there was a church age in the middle of it, and they didn't see that. They saw it all as one event. But when he comes, he's going to end all wars for the duration of his reign, because chariots and horses and bows are symbols of war, and there'll be no need for those things. He's going to speak peace to the world, and his dominion will stretch from sea to sea, which is a way of saying all around the world. Verse number 11. "As for thee also, by the blood of thy covenant, I have sent forth thy prisoners out of the pit wherein is no water." Tough verse. "Because of the covenant that I have made with Israel, I'm going to bring them out of the dry pit that they've been in." Perhaps we could say that Israel's been in a dry well for a long time, but God will remember his covenant and he'll bring them out of it. By the way, verse 11 is written in the past tense, so it's as good as done. I'm going to do it, but you go ahead and mark it down. It's done. Verse 12. "Turn you to the strongholds, you prisoners of hope. Even today do I declare that I will render double unto thee." They've had twice as much pain as anybody. That God's come out, going to give them twice the blessing as anybody. By the way, Israel is the firstborn of God. The firstborn always got a double portion of the blessing. Don't ask me to explain it, but don't ask me to not believe it either. You say, "Oh, that's not what verse 12 thinks about, believes that." That's what it says. I believe it. If you don't believe it, find your Bible that you do believe. Verse 13. "When I have bent Judah for me, filled the bow with Ephraim, and raised up thy sons, O Zion, against thy sons, O Greece, and made thee as the sword of a mighty man. And the Lord shall be seen over them, and his arrow shall go forth as the lightning. And the Lord God shall blow the trumpet and shall go with whirlwinds of the south." I believe that's what that's saying, is that one day he's going to use Judah to defeat Greece. but there's going to be a greater defeat to come. Judah is the bow, Ephraim is the arrow. God's going to use them as a weapon to do a number on the sons of Greece. It happened one time in history. And by the way, it was during the 400 years between the Testaments. There was a Grecian king, a ruler, I've already mentioned him, Antiochus Epiphanes, one of the most vile men to ever live, hated the Jews. When he came into Jerusalem, abomination of desolation, he came in, he was stuffed pork down the throats of the priest, forced them to eat it. He took a pig and slaughtered it on the altar in the temple and splattered the blood all over. They called it the abomination of desolation. And it was so revolting to the Jews that there was a guy named Judas Maccabeus. And he got his sons together and said, "We've had enough." And they raised up a mercenary rebel army and they defeated Antiochus Epiphanes. And it could be that these verses point to that time. And that scene, again, is to give us a signpost or a token of a historical ultimate victory that God is going to give them over their enemies. And then in verse 15, I waited a long time to get to this verse. But here's the verse 15. The Lord of hosts shall defend them, and they shall devour and subdue with sling stones, and they shall drink and make a noise as through wine, and they shall be filled like bowls and as the corners of the altar. When I was a kid preacher, there was a number of ways that you could test a kid preacher. Back in my days, we were tougher than kid preachers now, because now you've got to give a kid preacher 2 weeks to prepare. Back then, we were called on the spot. I remember sometimes that you'd have a preaching contest, you'd have a number of preachers, and one way that you could do it, Brother Eric, is that you'd have to come up and you'd have to open your Bible, put your finger on a verse, read it, and preach. Like I told you, they don't make them now like they used to in my day. I heard about one preacher that did that. He was called up and he opened his Bible, put his finger down and looked down, and it was at 1 Chronicles 1, verse 1. And he said, "I want to take that verse and I want to prove on how I know there is a God. For only God could come up with names like that." I heard about the preacher that was in a preacher's fellowship where they called preachers from the floor. You have no notice, just, "Brother, you are next after this special." And they called a preacher to come up, and he didn't come prepared. He didn't have an outline. He didn't have anything. So he came up and he opened his Bible up to the Gospel of Luke, and he read the story of Zacchaeus climbing up a tree. And he said, "I want to preach this morning on the story of Zacchaeus." And he said, "I've got 3 points." And he said, "Number one, Zacchaeus was a wee little man, and right now, that's how I feel, a wee little man." He said, "Number two, Zacchaeus was up a tree." And he said, "Right now," he said, I'm up a tree." He said, "Number three," he said, "Zacchaeus got down." And I think I will too. If I was in a preaching contest and I had to open my Bible and put my finger down and preach from one verse, I would rather read from 1 Chronicles 1 than Zechariah 9 in verse number 15. Now, I could wax eloquent to you about all the commentators about how that's describing the battle of Armageddon that it may be talking about, but it may not be talking about it either. I don't have verse 15 figured out. So verse 16. "And the Lord their God shall save them in that day as the flock of His people. For they shall be as the stones of a crown lifted up as an ensign upon His land." Now the king is a shepherd and he's rescuing his flock. And the idea of a shepherd king is going to be found several times in the rest of the book of Zechariah. I just finished reading Dad's book that he wrote on The Lord is my shepherd, and that's all I want. And it'll come out soon, and you need to get it and read it. Here's what I thought about sanctified imagination, if there is such a thing. Do you know how that every nation has a national anthem? How that ours is America the Beautiful, Star Spangled Banner. National anthem. And I just thought, now this is not inspired or anything. Okay. What if the universal anthem for the kingdom of God is Psalm 23? What if the whole world is singing, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want"? There'll be the flock as the flock of His people. We come to verse 17. For how great is His goodness, and how great is His beauty. Corn shall make the young men cheerful, and new wine the maids. Look at this King and His coming, and be glad. He's going to supply all that is needed. There's going to be plenty. And how great is His goodness. The King is coming. And He's greater than Alexander the Great. Because the first time He came in humility. But the next time He comes in honor. And the first time He came in meekness. Well, the next time He comes in might. The first time He came in poverty. The next time He comes in power. The first time He came in shame. Well, the next time He comes in sovereignty. And Zechariah says it will be a glad and glorious day when He comes. I believe that God gives His people historical signposts to something greater that is coming. I believe they allowed Alexander the Great to come and defeat all the enemies except Israel to say that I'm bringing somebody much more greater that's going to defeat the enemies of Israel, but save Israel. I believe that He sent Judas Maccabeus to defeat Antiochus, but it's just a little historical picture of something greater that is to come. And I look at my life, and I look at the goodnesses of my life, and they're like little signposts to me of greater blessings. But my King comes. Alexander the Great, but Christ the lowly. What a King. Would you stand with me tonight? And it's Zechariah chapter number 9. Now I hope tonight that you go home and you do one of two things and you say, I know what Zechariah 9 is about. Or, you go home and say, that preacher ain't got no clue what that chapter's about. I'm going to study it for myself. Aren't you glad you serve King Jesus? Aren't you glad He's coming? I'm glad He's coming.